This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here, we enlighten you with the ayah 61 of Surah Yunus, recited by Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. وما تكون في شأن وما تتلو منه من قرآن وما تتلو وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب مبين وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And you are not engaged in any affair, nor do you recite concerning it any portion of the Quran, nor do you do any work, but we are witnesses over you when you enter into it. And there does not lie concealed from your Lord the weight of an atom in the earth or in the heaven, nor anything less than that, nor greater. But it is in a clear book.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Iran's leader says political divisions have put the U.S. on a downward spiral and has been constantly getting weaker under various presidents. Israeli forces attacked Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque with tear gas and stun grenades, injuring several worshippers and arresting others. Also in our headlines, former U.S. President Donald Trump is charged with 34 felony counts of falsifying business records with intent to defraud. Our top story for this half hour, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has called on officials to work hard to wean the Iranian economy off the dollar. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei says several countries have moved to de-dollarize their economy, which has helped them improve their economic condition. He also called for efforts to curb rampant inflation and boost domestic production to improve people's livelihood. He advised the authorities to help producers improve the quality of their products and get a bigger share of domestic and foreign markets. The leader noted that the world order is undergoing changes and Iran's adversaries are on the decline. Ayatollah Khamenei also said that even some Israeli officials have admitted that the Tel Aviv regime is about to collapse. Ayatollah Khamenei also said political divisions have put the U.S. on a downward spiral, adding that the country has been constantly getting weaker under various presidents, including under Joe Biden. The leader said the polarization emerged in the United States during the 2020 presidential elections and still remains strong. Tens of thousands of Iranians have taken part in a funeral procession to bid farewell to two military advisors of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps who lost their lives in an Israeli airstrike near the Syrian capital, Damascus, last week. Our correspondent, Gisum Misha Ahmadi, tells us more.
Caskets draped in Iranian flags and carried in a mass procession. People from all walks of life following the trucks carrying the coffins of Milad Haydari and Mehrdad Mehrani, making their way to Tehran's Shuhada Square from Imam Hussein Square, where the funeral ceremony began just a few hours earlier.
All of those who have attended the funeral are here to renew their allegiance to the values that these martyrs sacrificed their lives to uphold.
We are here to show that we will continue backing the Islamic Republic. The huge crowds that you see here have gathered today to thank our martyrs for the sacrifices they made. We owe our security to these martyrs who fought terrorism even outside our borders.
The Iranian IRGC military advisors were martyred in Friday's aerial assaults conducted by Israel on the suburbs of Damascus. Haydari, a 32-year-old father of two, was from Kurdistan province, and Mehrani, 31, who later succumbed to his wounds, had a two-year-old son.
I personally came here because my brother was murdered, and I strongly believe in the choice that they made. This murder will never be forgotten.
Attending this ceremony is the least we could do to send a strong message to the world, particularly to our enemies. It's also a token of our gratitude for what the martyrs have done and the sacrifices they've made.
We will support the Islamic Revolution to the last drop of our blood. We will support our leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, and no matter what happens, we will always support our martyrs.
Men and women in black followed them, weeping for the martyrs that sacrificed their lives in the fight against terrorism in the region. But most importantly, they are here to once again pledge allegiance to the values these martyrs died for.
Huge masses gathered downtown Tehran in Imam Hussein Square to bid farewell to the two martyrs and also to tell the world that they will continue to walk down their path. Yusufisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Syria warns of Israel's occupation and aggressive policies, which it believes will drive the region toward all-out escalation and a new phase of instability. Syria's foreign ministry says over the past 4 days, Israeli forces launched numerous attacks on areas in and around Damascus, Homs, and its countryside, killing innocent civilians. The ministry added that the regime enjoys impunity and unlimited support from the West and follows in the footsteps of its sponsors in exporting crises. Damascus underlines that Israel's approach flagrantly violates international law and the provisions of the UN Charter. Israeli forces have attacked Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque, violently beating and forcing them out of the holy site. The Palestine Red Crescent Society says over 400 Palestinians were injured after Israeli forces fired tear gas and stun grenades to force them out. Israeli forces arrested hundreds more while preventing medics from attending to those who were injured. Hamas and the Islamic Jihad resistance groups vehemently condemned the attack. They called on all Palestinians to march toward the occupied city of Al-Quds to protect Al-Aqsa Mosque. A Hamas spokesman called the attack part of Israel's religious war against Palestinians' sanctities. A number of rockets were fired toward Israeli settlements near the besieged Gaza Strip in response to the regime's attack on Al-Aqsa. Iran vehemently condemned the attack, urging an immediate reaction from the Muslim world and relevant international bodies. Egypt and Jordan also strongly condemned Israel's, quote, blatant assault on Al-Aqsa, calling for an immediate halt to it. Well, in a historic, unprecedented move, the United States' former President Donald Trump has been arrested and arraigned at a New York court where he pleaded not guilty. The Manhattan District Attorney said that he will not allow Trump to get away with breaking the law.
Earlier this afternoon, Donald Trump was arraigned on a New York Supreme Court indictment, returned by a Manhattan grand jury on 34 felony counts of falsifying business records in the first degree. Under New York state law, it is a felony to falsify business records with intent to defraud and an intent to conceal another crime. That is exactly what this case is about. 34 false statements made to cover up other crimes. These are felony crimes in New York State, no matter who you are. We cannot and will not normalize serious criminal conduct. On a New York Supreme Court indictment, returned by a Manhattan jury.
Bragg said the 34 felony counts stem from 3 hush money payments made to people who claim to have negative information about Trump. That includes $130,000 to adult film actress Stormy Daniels just days before Trump's election win. The district attorney said Trump committed the crime of falsifying business records to, quote, promote his candidacy.
Why did Donald Trump repeatedly make these false statements? The evidence will show that he did so to cover up crimes relating to the 2016 election. Donald Trump, executives at the publishing company American Media Incorporated, Mr. Cohen, and others agreed in 2015 to a catch and kill scheme. That is, a scheme to buy and suppress negative information to help Mr. Trump's chance of winning the election.
Taken together, the charges carry a maximum sentence of more than 100 years in prison under New York law, but an actual prison sentence, if he's convicted at trial, would almost certainly be shorter than that. Speaking after the court session, Trump claimed he was the victim of election interference.
And now this massive election interference at a scale never seen before in our country, beginning with the radical left, George Soros-backed prosecutor Alvin Bragg of New York. As it turns out, virtually everybody that has looked at this case, including rhinos and even hardcore Democrats, say there is no crime and that it should never have been brought. Never have been brought. Everybody.
Trump said the judge in the case is a, quote, Trump-hating judge. His lawyers have vowed to fight the 34 criminal counts, calling the indictment sad and boilerplate. Trump was released from custody without any pretrial restrictions. A trial could potentially start in January 2024. His lawyers have indicated they would rather push it back to spring. Trump leads the race to be the Republican nominee for the 2024 presidential election. Colin Campbell is joining us now from Washington. Colin, it seems that the American public can't get enough political drama as it comes. What are we expecting to see in the next few weeks following the arrest of Donald Trump?
This drama has been playing out for quite a while. If we remember, just a couple weeks ago, the former president asked his supporters to protest in the streets because he was going to be arrested 2 weeks ago. Well, since then, he raised millions of dollars. Some say it was part of his grift. But we do know that the former president was finally arrested earlier on Tuesday here in the U.S. and the New York, state of New York, in Manhattan, where he faced charges of bank fraud, more than 30 counts of bank fraud, as you alluded to before. We're not going to hear too much as far as legal proceedings in the upcoming weeks in regard to this case. It's believed that it will not continue until December of this year. I'm unsure as to why the calendar has such a giant space in it between the beginning of April and the end of the year when we are supposed to hear or at least see the hearing for this case. I'll have to find out some more information on that. But as far as it's not over, expected to be up related to other issues that could have been regarded as criminal behavior, one dealing with the amount of votes in Georgia, where he asked the Secretary of State to find him more votes so he could win that state, and of course, any connection, influence, or control, or encouragement he had in relation to the January 6th insurrection on the nation's capital, where there were thousands of protesters, some of whom barged into the Capitol, and of course, rummaged through it and rioted through it while the president was largely silent until it seemed like things were getting way too out of control when he finally made a comment and told protesters not to to protest peacefully. So there, he does still have to answer to that. Some people believe that there may be some criminality there and he could be indicted on those charges. But as far as the charges on bank fraud, we're not going to hear much until the end of the year, except for lots of media talking about what happened this week and whether or not this will have implications on his 2024 run.
All right, thanks a lot, Colin Campbell, joining us from Washington. Peru's president survives impeachment over crackdown on protests following the ouster of her predecessor in December. The Congress rejected a motion from leftist lawmakers to launch impeachment hearings against President Dina Boluarte on charges tied to the death of protesters. The final vote tally saw 37 mostly leftist lawmakers vote in favor of impeachment but failed to get the required 52 votes for a trial to potentially remove Boluarte. The opposition blames Boluarte for protest-related deaths. She is also under investigation for alleged money laundering and campaign finance crimes during the 2021 presidential race. She denies all the accusations. Peru has been mired in intense political infighting for years, with several recent ex-presidents ousted, arrested, or jailed. Moving on, the United States has unveiled $2.6 billion in military assistance to Ukraine that includes 3 air surveillance radars, anti-tank rockets, and fuel trucks. The Pentagon said the United States will provide Ukraine with capabilities to meet its immediate battlefield and security needs. Washington has supplied Ukraine with billions of dollars in aid ever since the war began in February 2022. The U.S. has spearheaded an international coalition to back Kiev and coordinated aid from dozens of countries. Moscow has time and again warned that the military assistance will only prolong the war. And Finland has officially joined the U.S.-led NATO despite Russia's concerns about the Western military alliance's eastward expansion.
Well, with receipt of this instrument of accession, we can now declare that Finland is the 31st member of the North Atlantic Treaty.
Foreign Minister Pekka Haavisto handed over Finland's accession papers to U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, the formal keeper of NATO's founding treaty. Finnish President Sauli Niinisto hailed the start of a new era for his country following the event. U.S. President Joe Biden has welcomed Finland while urging Turkey and Hungary to drop their objections for Sweden to join without delay. Meanwhile, Russia, which is against NATO's expansionist agenda, warned of countermeasures. Moscow has vowed to strengthen its defenses in western and northwestern regions. Finland, alongside Sweden, applied to join the alliance last year following Russia's military offensive in Ukraine. Political analyst George Samueli argues that with Finland officially joining the U.S.-led military alliance, NATO is now a larger threat to Russia.
So NATO is kind of gloating. Jens Stoltenberg keeps gloating. Mr. Putin wanted less NATO. Now he's got more NATO. Okay, he's got more NATO. That means that Europe is now in a more perilous position than it was before. We don't know yet how the war in Ukraine is going to play out, because it's quite possible that the war will escalate into a direct confrontation between NATO and Russia, in which case Russia may well take some kind of preemptive measures in order to avoid any kind of NATO offensive through Finland. But there's no question, I mean, that by incorporating Finland into NATO, NATO has got itself an awful lot of valuable piece of real estate from which it can launch military operations against Russia. I mean, it's now right up against the White Sea, the Barents Sea, Murmansk, Archangel. It's for the Russians, that is a serious threat that NATO has now embarked upon.
That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
The whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the all-merciful, the all-compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
God's month. In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of this series. The blessed month of Ramadan is the time of attending the school of the pure servants of God, those who are called in the Quran as Awliya Allah or friends of Allah. They will take our hand and guide us in the right path. Allah appointed Muhammad as his last prophet to salvage mankind from worshipping and servitude of idols. Ayah 21 of Surah Ahzab reads, "Indeed, there is for you in the Apostle of Allah a good exemplar for those who look forward to Allah and the Last Day. Therefore, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, is the best example of servitude for the entire mankind. The Prophet used to worship days and nights even before prophethood. He would pray and supplicate at midnights. The Messenger of Mercy would shed tears in his supplications to the extent that his near ones told him, Why are you weeping so much while God has made you pure from any pollution and evilness, and you have no sin? The prophet answered, Shouldn't I be a grateful servant? Imam Ali, peace upon him, says, Whoever reforms his relation with God, God will reform his relation with people. God has set the blessed month of Ramadan as the best period for revising our relation with him through prayer and supplication. Every righteous deed will be rewarded manifold in this month. Thank God that he didn't deprive us of supplication to him. The moments of solitude with God are the best times for speaking directly with God and beseeching him to forgive our sins. In Dua Iftitah, which has been taught by the Prophet's last infallible successor, Imam Mahdi, we read, All praise belongs to Allah, whose curtain of concealing the flaws of servants is not torn, and whose door of mercy is not closed, and whose beggar is not driven away, and whose hopeful is not disappointed. No doorkeeper can block the way of entering God's court. He hears and answers whomever calls him. More importantly, it is he who invites his servants to ask him and demand him their needs. His door of mercy is not closed to those who call him and plead to him. His beggars are not banished. God is the hope of every hopeful, as he has opened the door of his mercy and forgiveness, and everyone can enter his mercy at any time of the day or night. In this part of the supplication, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, means to say that Allah is eagerly waiting for the servants to appeal to him and ask him for whatever they want. He needs no precondition and no mediator. He is ready round the clock to hear the prayers and supplications of his servants. Ayah 5 of Surah Qisas gives a great hope to those who have been oppressed in the world. It reads, And we desire to show favor to those who are abased on the earth and to make them imams and to make them the heirs. Sure, we keep our hope in God's promise, and this hope is real once it acts as an impetus to cause us move toward our demand. It has been narrated that idleness is the key to all miseries. In addition, the commander of the faithful and the leader of the pious, Imam Ali, peace upon him, says that the hope which does not cause effort is but a lie. He says in Sermon 160 of Nahjul Balagha, he claims that he is hopeful of God. By Allah the Great, he is lying. Why is his hope not demonstrated in his deed? Anyone who is hopeful, his hope is manifested in his deed. We hope that we are honest and make effort in the way of materializing the divine promise. It is the promise which all divine religions have given, namely, the emergence of the Redeemer of mankind. Definitely, the true way therefore Imam Mahdi's coming is he who does his best to set the ground for justice through fighting the vestiges of injustice and corruption. A very simple logic in this regard is that we wait for spring to come while we fight winter and cold with heating homes and wearing warm clothes. Nobody can say, "All right, I am expecting the arrival of spring and warmer days, but I do not put on warm clothes and I will live in frosty weather without making fire." We ask God to send his greetings to Muhammad and his Ahlul Bayt and to remove our grief. O God, cut our need to the world and make us eager to what is with you. Bestow your trust on us. O Lord, grant us patience and forbearance and make us stable on the right path and make us triumph over the faithless.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome back to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week, we look at a trending news story which has a direct relevance to the religion of Islam, and we break it down from a Muslim perspective. The favourite to become the next leader of Scotland, the Scottish Health Secretary, Hamza Yousaf, has caused a huge debate in the Muslim community by saying he believes that same-gender marriage is equal to heterosexual marriage, a position which Islam does not condone. So on today's show, we're going to discuss to what extent Muslim politicians should represent their faith in public life. Here's more context on the story.
A new issue has risen for Muslims living in the West. Politicians from a Muslim background compromising on Islam in order to further their political careers. The most recent example was seen in Scotland, with Scottish Nationalist Party leadership candidate Hamza Yousaf taking the un-Islamic position of supporting same-sex relationships when questioned by journalists about his religious stance.
Just to be crystal clear on this, do you think that gay sex is a sin?
Oh, look, I've answered this question time and time and time and time again. No matter how many times, Sophie, you ask the question, I believe in equal marriage. I believe that people's marriage, if they are gay and they are married, that their marriage is no less, is no more inferior or less, is worth less than my marriage as a heterosexual.
Other prominent examples of Muslim politicians abandoning Islamic norms include American Senator Ilhan Omar and British London Mayor Sadiq Khan, both of whom have been condemned by traditionalist Muslims for their pro-LGBT stances among other controversial positions, including support for Israel and the Western war machine.
My name is Sadiq Khan. And now more so than ever before, I say it's with great pride, I am the Mayor of London!
Some argue that compromising is a necessary evil in order to gain Muslims' political representation. However, Muslims in high office rarely ever champion issues of concern to the community, particularly Islamic positions, which are considered controversial according to Western worldviews. The issue can be so divisive between Muslims that some scholars now condone the opinion that Muslims should not engage in the democratic process of disbelieving nations. But the debate rages on.
Well, joining us in the studio today to talk about Muslims in public life, we have Lubaba Khalid, who is currently a young Labour BME officer and previously was the Vice President of Welfare at the University of Westminster Student Union. Her work has centred on the attainment gap, decolonialisation of the university and anti-racism work. Lubaba, thank you so much for joining me on the show. Now, just tell me, what do you make of this story coming out of Scotland? It's obviously a difficult situation that Hamza Yusuf has been put in. It seems as if he's being focused on specifically because of his Muslim background.
Yeah, that's the reality because, you know, he's running against another candidate who is a very strong Christian. I've now forgotten her name. What's her name?
Forbes,
yeah. You know, and she's a strong Christian and she was asked the same questions around, you know, gay sex and things like that. And she didn't get the same backlash as Hamza Yusuf. So one can only think that, can only come to the conclusion that the backlash that he's getting and the question that he's come is inherently from an Islamophobic position than it being about the politics that he's running on and the policies that he would like to see if elected.
It seems as if Muslims are in this rock and a hard place. They're kind of stuck where if they choose to stand by traditionalist Islamic interpretations, the kind of thing they would have been brought up to believe, then, of course, they'll become potentially persecuted. They won't be able to pursue mainstream careers, for example, like Hamza Yusuf. If he took a different position on this subject, I doubt he would have been treated so well. Mm-hmm. Even though he took a pro-Western viewpoint on this issue, he's still being grilled by the media. But I think with Forbes, the Christian alternative, she has taken some controversial positions as well from a mainstream position, but because, you know, she's white British, she's perhaps given the freedom to be controversial without this kind of like, well, her career's going to be completely destroyed as a result of that. Just tell me, as someone, as a Muslim yourself in this country who's, you know, getting involved in politics now, what's the atmosphere like for Muslims in the political sphere right now?
It's very hostile. It's hostile. It is a struggle to find the balance where we're not compromising our morals and our religion, but also wanting to create that change in society and things like that. So it is really tough. A lot of Muslim politicians that may have started off with the right politics and the right reasons and the right morals and things like that for now have been forced to accept these ideas that do contradict our religion. And we shouldn't be somewhat scared to say that. It is written in our scriptures. It is written. These things are not acceptable in Islam. But we're now in a situation where we're being forced to. But then the reality is this is not accepted in the three Abrahamic faiths as well. And I think people do forget that as well. So
it seems like, because this is obviously a secular country by and large, I think, you know, to describe as a Christian country right now is quite rich.
Yeah.
It's hard to find someone who identifies as a Christian these days.
Yeah.
So it seems as if there might be some kind of attack on religion. You mentioned quite rightly that this is a view that all the Abrahamic religions adhere to. It's not just Islam, but it seems as if anyone who is religious and pursues a public career, they can be demonized just for having those opinions, just for believing in their religion. And standing by those principles, they can be demonized. Do you think that that's the case?
I feel like there is a more acceptance to attack Muslims than it would be for, let's say, Catholics or Jewish people.
Really?
I feel like there is a more acceptance that society has created with, you know, with 9/11 and the narrative around terrorism and things like that, that it's become a lot more acceptable to frame Muslims as extreme, as their religion being extreme, than it is for other religions. I think currently that's what we're really, I think that's where we are right now in terms of, yes, it might be something that's in within all three religions, but I feel like it's accepted now within society that you can be Islamophobic and you won't be challenged on it. So.
Well, for more on this subject, we've also been able to speak to the veteran journalist Yvonne Ridley, who is currently a national executive member of the ALBA Party, which is a Scottish nationalist and pro-independence party.
Humza Yousaf has boxed himself into a corner at the moment on mixed marriage, and you have to wonder, well, he's sounding more like a career politician than a conviction politician. Whereas one of his rivals for the First Minister leadership is Kate Forbes, who is a committed Christian, but she's obviously, looking at her background, more of a conviction politician. She has come out, drawn her red lines. I will do this, I believe in this, but I will not agree to certain issues. At the end of the day, all of these politicians, regardless of whatever faith they hold, they are representing a mixed community, people of faith and people of no faith. And so in order to represent them fairly, they can't afford to have too many red lines that are going to upset certain religious or even non-religious sensibilities. Some people might think that Muslims are on a hiding to nothing because if they embrace the fortitude of Kate Forbes, who was quite adamant about her religious position on legislation, their critics would say, oh, this is Islamism coming into it. This politician is a fundamentalist, he's an extremist, he's dangerous. And of course, we all know in Britain that Islamophobia really is a very long word for racism. And unfortunately, we know that Britain, especially in the establishment, is institutionally racist. It's just there. So politicians from the Islamic faith, especially olive-skinned politicians, wouldn't be given the same latitude that Kate Forbes has been given. In fact, her rather obstinate position, non-negotiable position on same-sex marriages, has earned her a lot of respect, because she has stood by her guns. So it may be that her position to refuse to compromise anything that would affect her faith may actually serve her well in the end, because people do like politicians who are decisive. The danger is that Muslims will not engage, will withdraw into an Islamic bubble and not get involved in politics. And that is the last thing that we want to see. I have lived in Scotland now for more than 10 years and can see the difference between the Scottish communities and the English communities, Muslim communities. And the Scottish Muslims are very happy to wave the Scottish saltire, the blue and white flag, and celebrate the famous poet Robbie Burns, and celebrate St. Andrew's Day, which is the patron saint of Scotland. And they seem quite relaxed and able to do that. And, you know, Humza Yousaf, when he took his parliamentary oath, he swore on the Holy Quran while other ministers swore on the Bible. He swore on the Holy Quran. He was wearing a kilt in Islamic tartan. We have our own tartan in Scotland. And that message is so powerful. And what the message is saying is anyone, regardless of faith or skin colour, can take part in government. And this trickles down to kids who are looking up at these politicians and thinking, yeah, I can do that. Not just Muslims, Jews as well. Yeah. More than 40 Jewish Labour members have been, they've said, persecuted and hounded out of the party. Because since Keir Starmer arrived, we've now learned that there are two sets of Jews. There are good Jews who support Israel and are Zionists and are proud to say that they're Zionists. And then there are bad Jews who don't believe in Israel, are very hostile to human rights, abuses in Israel. And of course, they're perceived to be bad Jews and have been thrown out of the party. With the exception, I think, of one who's decided to take legal action, and the Labour Party has apologised.
Well, before we continue the studio discussion, let's take a look at what people on the streets of London have to say about this. We spoke to two Muslims to give their issues on this particular subject.
Politicians like Sadiq Khan, who were elected on a basis that were Muslim, should not go and compromise on their religion. I feel like if you're being elected on the basis of being a Muslim and you're representing a certain group of society, you shouldn't go against what they elected you on. And as a person who studies politics, it comes with democracy and representation as well. You're voted on a basis that people believe you're the person to put their ideas across, and once you start going against them, you shouldn't be in power.
Hi, everyone. My name is Itisham Slamikam. I'm a councillor for this area, so I'm at Wembley Hill. In the 5 years that I have been elected, I haven't actually been put into a position where I've had to compromise my principles. But not because of anything else other than we are believers in justice and equality, freedom and principles of empathy and compassion. The issue that's going on there, and I have differences, let's say. I'm trying to be diplomatic with those who have a stance on particularly the situation in Israel and Palestine, which is not right, I'll be honest. Our religion tells us not to kind of judge other people, but obviously in particular instances where we can have disagreements with them and we can have conversations, and I think that should be where we are allowed to have kind of differences of opinion, but at least we should have that conversation. If we stifle debate, then that is the point where they've already lost. If they want to stifle debate on certain issues and they're not open to having those conversations, then it shows like a lack of moral strength or intellectual integrity.
What about Baroness Wazi? Someone like her, did she compromise on her Islamic principles to remain in politics?
Irrespective of whichever party you are from, you need to make sure you don't compromise on your principles. And I know that she has done a lot trying to highlight the levels of Islamophobia that are present, again, not just within the Conservative Party, but across this country. We are still a racist, sexist, misogynistic kind of country, an old imperial, colonial kind of country. We still have the remnants of that. So in terms of what she has doing, it's positive that she is highlighting it. But if she's the lone voice, and let's be honest, the Tory party are so right-wing now that they are painting Muslims as the enemy. If she is a lone voice in that battle, then she can only do so much. Again, I'm trying to be as diplomatic as possible. I don't agree with a lot of what, again, she stands, she's a member of a party that I totally and vehemently disagree with. But in terms of her as a person, as an individual, if she is the only person that's doing it...
Well, there you have it. Plenty of views we've heard on this issue now. Now, obviously, the LGBT issue in Scotland is not the only example of where Muslims have entered into politics in the West, and it appears as if they've had to compromise from one degree or another. Other areas would be, say, on the Palestinian issue, the Palestinian cause. It seems like London Mayor Sadiq Khan has expressed a great interest in going to visit Israel, for example, and is very happy to do so, in his view. Ilhan Omar in the US, a Muslim senator, has voted for resolutions which are branded as pro-Israel as well, and also support for Western wars, that type of thing. So just tell me where you stand on this, Lubaba, because obviously I think most Muslims, if not all, would say that these are red line issues. We shouldn't be compromising on Palestine and other issues.
So in context, my mother is Palestinian, so Palestine is something I will never compromise on. I can't, because that is my identity. One thing I will never understand is when someone compromises on seeing the oppressed, because we know in Islam it is our responsibility as an ummah, as a community, to stand on the side of the oppressed. And that should not be controversial. That shouldn't be something that is striving debate or what did the guy say that the previous on the video where, you know, having to be diplomatic about it. Personally, I don't think we do, not on something like Palestine, especially in something like Palestine, something that's happening right now in China with the Uyghur Muslims. Syria is another example. These are issues that, no, we don't need to be diplomatic about. We should be very clear that we will stand on the side of the people that are constantly being murdered on a daily basis, that their land is being taken away from. And that's what Islam tells us to do as well. And so I get very agitated, I get frustrated, obviously as a Muslim, but I think it's mainly as a Palestinian, when I see that people get elected on the oppression of my people and then they get elected and they throw it all away. And to be fair, this is not something that I've just seen among Muslims. You see it among the white left as well, that will talk about Palestine, will be openly talk about it, but then as soon as they get into their positions, they forget about it all. And so, yeah.
Do you think then, in that case, that there is an issue here? Because, as you said, when Muslims get into politics, not talking about yourself here, but other candidates, when they get high-ranking levels in politics, they are expected to compromise on this. To be pro-Palestine, as we saw with Jeremy Corbyn, for example, can get you in a lot of hot water. So they may opt to go for a more mainstream opinion on it, which is to be impartial, if not basically pro-Israel on the subject.
Then what's the point of being in... What's the point of going up in ranks? What is the point? Then that's the question we have to ask ourselves then. Should we be encouraging Muslim representation in politics, in positions, to get them in positions of power, like, for example, Sadiq Khan as the current mayor, if that will not benefit us in any way or form and it then leads to compromise, then genuinely, and it's a question that I feel like we do need to ask ourselves, that should we be asking for that representation? Because is it not worse then? Because then what happens is that you have Muslims who are in positions of these positions of power, you could say, who've compromised on their views. And then there's an expectation now for any Muslim who decides to go into those positions of power to also compromise. So then the question really is, what's the point?
It
sounds very harsh, but that's the question we have to ask ourselves. Then is there a point in encouraging Muslim representation in the current political sphere that we're in?
Do you think that we actually have Muslim representation at the moment?
No, I actually, and again, this is, I actually believe we have socialist representation who just happen to be Muslim, who just happen to be people of colour. But I think it's a very pick and choose for a lot of Muslims. Like, I understand me, and, you know, one thing we are taught in Islam is not to assume what a person's going through.
Yeah.
But I do recognise they are under a lot of pressure, an enormous amount of pressure. I do recognise that. But at the same time, it really depends on the individual. If they were elected on the basis that they were Muslim before their politics, then you have an expectation and you have a responsibility to represent being a Muslim in its whole, and you can't pick and choose when to give things up and when to, you know, do that. But if you were elected on socialist policies or Tory policies or whatever it is, but then you just happen to be Muslim, then that's a different ball game altogether in terms of that discussion. But when you, and I think that's where the conversation with Sadiq Khan comes into account, is that he did play on that Muslim card. He played on being a son of a bus driver to get votes, to then get elected and not actually do anything for that community he claimed to, that he was serving. That's where the problem comes.
I appreciate your time. Of course, this situation is ongoing, so we'll have to see how it develops. But we have reached the end of the show. But thank you very much, Lubaba, for appearing with us. And thank you to everyone at home. This is another edition of Eye on Islam that successfully come to an end. But don't worry, we'll be back next week for another edition of the show. But for now, Assalamu alaikum.
Limelight. Countries are one by one seeking alternatives to the US dollar. This time, India is set to reduce the use of US dollar in cross-border trade. New Delhi is seeking to substantially boost the nation's exports by 2030. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Press TV, India has opted to offer its Indian rupee, INR, as a trade currency alternative to the US dollar after it unveiled its latest dynamic and responsive foreign trade policy in a bid for de-dollarization. According to the Indian Commerce Secretary, Sunil Bartal, Indian rupee will be used in trade countries that are facing a shortage of dollar or currency failure. He said trade between India and Malaysia can now be settled in INR. Trade between India and Malaysia can now be settled in Indian rupee, INR, in addition to the current modes of settlement in other currencies. This follows the decision by the Reserve Bank of India in July 2022 to allow the settlement of international trade in the Indian rupee. The Ministry of External Affairs announced, it further said, this initiative by the Reserve Bank of India, RBI, is aimed at facilitating the growth of global trade and to support the interest of the global trading community in Indian rupees. In the unveiling of the new foreign trade policy for 2023 to 2028, one of the main goals of the new trade strategy, according to Bartal, is to encourage the internationalization of the rupee and, according to Commerce and Industry Minister Piyush Goyal, to increase the Indian exports of goods and services to $2 trillion by 2030. In addition, Bangladesh is also eyeing to start trading with India using INR after the Ministry of Commerce placed a written recommendation at the last cabinet meeting regarding the possibility and opportunity of using rupee instead of dollar. The use of rupee will start with Bangladesh's $2 trillion trade with India. Bangladesh Bank has almost finished all kinds of trials in this regard. Trading in rupee will be introduced in both countries only after bilateral decision on some issues, an executive director of Bangladesh Bank said. For Russia, rupee trade was made as the centerpiece of the new plan, as New Delhi aims for wider policy to secure a global status for the currency and allow it to be used for international trade settlement. Currently, India is trading in rupees with Russia, Iran, Mauritius and Sri Lanka. The announcement came in amid official efforts to secure and safeguard the Indian international trade from the impact of the Ukrainian crisis. Ever since the Russian economy was sanctioned by the West over the Ukraine crisis, trading with the US dollar as a means has become immensely difficult. Hence, countries have started opting for alternative currencies to break US hegemony over international trade. Likewise, Iran had ditched the US dollar last year and had started trading with Russia in their respective national currencies, the Iranian rial and ruble, which further enabled Iran to bypass the US dominant global financial system. The BRICS countries, including Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, and of which Iran and Saudi Arabia would soon be a part of, are working on creating a new form of currency to kill the US hegemony. These countries are set to present ideas on its development at the forthcoming summit of the organization in South Africa, as announced by Deputy Chairman of the Russian State Duma, Alexander Babakov, recently.